I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a leading crowdfunding site. The company enables the public to fund creative projects related to film, food, design, and music. So if you're a musician who wants to create an independent album, you can go to Kickstarter, describe your project, how much money you need, and hope that visitors to the site will contribute. Yancey co-founded the company in 2009 with Perry Chen and Charles Adler. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you were growing up, did you have a sense that you would be an entrepreneur?
Never. My entire goal growing up was to be a writer. I loved to read. I was always good at school, you know, but my dream was to be a writer. And, you know, there were various books that made me want to do that. All the President's Men was a book I reread all the time, and I very desperately wanted that kind of experience. And that's what I pursued through college. And, you know, I took it very seriously, and I got my first freelance writing jobs during college. And after school, I became a writer full time. And that was sort of living the dream, moving here to New York and doing that. And then I think there was a certain point where I realized that that world is a little small for me, that maybe I was better at more things beyond just writing and thinking about language and how to write about music or whatever the topic was. And so I sort of realized I started working in companies and organizations that I thrived in those situations, that I could be decisive. I knew how to do various things. But, you know, this whole thing with Kickstarter just sort of fell into it.
What do your parents do? Are they in the literary field?
Not at all. I mean, my father's sells furniture. My mother was a secretary. She recently went back to school and now is an accountant. My stepfather's a auto mechanic, and my stepmother sells real estate. So it's a working class family. I grew up certainly not having money in a very rural area in Southwest Virginia outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, where Virginia Tech is. And it's a great place to grow up. But nothing about it would lead me to where I've gotten to be now. I think that, you know, growing up in a small town like that, you're unaware of how big the rest of the world is. And, you know, fortunately through books and all these other ways, I got this greater sense of what possibility there was.
You grew up on a farm. Who was the farmer?
Well, we rented a house. There's this old house built in 1863, I think it was. It's a white house with a red tin roof, and you could see the house from about 5 miles away because the roof would just pop out of the trees. It was kind of nice. But it's this falling down house, and we just rented it. Our family did for $100 a month, and farmers worked the land. So I would work for them during the summers, but they would raise cattle there, and they're, you know, cattle for beef, so they would take them away, and you'd hear the rest of the cows cry, you know, that mm-hmm. night. And there was, you know, there was sort of a rhythm to it. It's a nice thing to talk about now, being in New York, because it makes me exotic, but I hated it at the time. I mean, I just wanted to read books and, you know, think about things like that. I did not thrive on country living. But I look back at it now with some level of fondness.
So the farming life wasn't for you, and you wanted to be a writer. Did your parents ever push back on that?
Not at all. I was never pressure whatsoever. I think if anything, my father wanted me to be a rock star, so it might have been the opposite direction.
Speaking of rock star, you have an interest in music. You were a music journalist or a music critic prior to starting Kickstarter. What role did music play in your life?
It was huge. I mean, my father wanted to be a musician his entire life. He was a folk artist, and he had bands. I played very briefly in a band with him when I was in high school, a band called Rock Bottom, which is kind of appropriately named. But music was always, you know, was my identity, you know, and I was a weird kid in high school, and, you know, I was one of those kids. But music is where I saw this other world that I could possibly be a part of. And as someone who is, you know, intelligent and is curious, you know, that quest for learning more about music is a very exciting thing, especially pre-internet. Mm-hmm. You know, I would buy magazines just to look for names of bands I'd never heard of before so I could try to find out what they sounded like. So that mm-hmm. that level of discovery was a huge part of how I grew as a person. And I played music myself, not very well, and eventually realized I couldn't make music that I myself liked, and that was a hard thing to recognize. And so then I began, you know, to write and, you know, use my ability to be pretty strong with words and to talk about records that I liked. But at a certain point, that sort of gets to be not enough. It's not, you know, emotionally fulfilling.
Since there was some type of frustration with your career prior mm-hmm. to starting Kickstarter, to what extent did you start the company because of that, you know, you're having itchy feet to do something else versus really having a visceral interest, a holistic interest in the company?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely wholly a strong, genuine interest in what we do. I mean, it really is it. But, you know, it's not hard to look at the music industry and think this is not going to be here for very long. And, you know, I look at my very good friends who are still in that world, and not many of them are employed anymore. And so, you know, you're watching the sand leave the hourglass, and, you know, you're starting to think, I need to get out of here. So certainly that was in the air. But, you know, the Kickstarter is without question the greatest thing I've ever had the privilege to do with my life. And I don't know if I'll ever have the opportunity to do something so good again.
Your co-founder, Perry Chen, had the original idea for Kickstarter. You met him randomly at a restaurant in Brooklyn. What was that first encounter like?
Perry first had the idea in 2002. He's from New York originally, and he moved back to New Orleans, where he also went to college. And he went there, and he was trying to put on a concert. And he didn't have the money to do it. It was going to cost, you know, a lot of money up front to make it happen. And out of that, you know, he wished that there was some way he could know beforehand how many people were interested. If a certain number were interested, the show could happen because there were enough people. If there weren't, then the show wouldn't happen. And just this very simple trigger. Mm. And that was really the origin of Kickstarter right there. And so then in 2005, fall of 2005, there's a restaurant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn called Diner, and it's a nice restaurant. And I used to go there a lot, and Perry was a waiter there. And we got to be friends, and, you know, eventually one day he mentioned this idea he had. And, you know, he mentioned it to me because at the time my day job was working on the web in an editorial way, but I worked on the internet. And so that, you know, that meant I knew more about the web than he did, and so I could help him with this idea. So he shared this concept to me of this trigger that people decide for themselves what gets funded and what happens. And so, you know, I could see the merit of it, although I was a little nervous about it at first, too, because I thought, well, this is American Idol. This isn't how you create great art. But as we talked it through more, just thinking of all those niches and enclaves in the world that just get ignored, but there is a support system there and a fan base there and all that who could decide for themselves. And then about a year later, we met Charles, who I mentioned before, our third founder. And Charles was more technical than either of us. He was a designer, but we still didn't have that core tech team. And that took a while to put together. So from the moment of really working on this in a very concentrated way to the site's launch, there's 4 years in between there.
What did you do to support yourself in those 4 years?
Well, I still had my day job. I was working at a music service called eMusic at the time. So I was doing that during the day, and at night I was working on this. Perry quit waiting. I mean, he was full-time trying to make Kickstarter happen. And he had some savings, and he lives light anyway. And same with Charles. You know, there's no way this doesn't happen if the two of them aren't working at this full-time and refusing to let this fail. I mean, there were numerous opportunities for us to quit. And there are times where, you know, empirically maybe we should have, but there was a persistence and a stubbornness that saw it through.
What were some turning points in those early days before the site launched that you thought, you know what, actually we're going to stick with this? And by the way, it was inexpensive for you because you were doing your other job anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I had more of a safety net, and that was a source of conflict for sure. You know, mm-hmm. the one guy who doesn't quit his job, but I just, you know, I had no money and no way to hack it. And I just wasn't ready for that jump. And so there are a number of milestones, good and bad. I mean, the biggest mistake that we made, and a mistake that I think a lot of people probably now are making, is that we tried to outsource the development of the site. So we ourselves did not know how to code. So we went to outside firms and hired them to code the site. And, you know, we were repeatedly told by the few people we met in the tech world that this is a terrible idea. This never works. Like, this never works out. And our reaction to that was, whatever, old man. You know, what do you know? it's different for us. You don't know how it is these days. And we really believed that. And then we realized after going down that path two or three different times and it not working out in really significant ways that we realized that this was true. So a big turning point there was we met a woman named Sunny Bates. And Sunny is a Uber connector. She's the fastest talker you will ever meet. She lives here in the city. And she's just a lovely woman. Sonny shares a dog walker with a friend of Perry's from college, and so we met Sonny through that, and we became just the two downtown boys that she got to help out, and she really liked us immediately, and we just were blown away by her, and she's just a force. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know anybody, and so we told her our idea, and we were these, you know, two earnest guys with a piece of paper, and she was like, I'll take you around. I'll introduce you. So we were able to talk to people that we definitely would not have otherwise.
Who are some of the people whom you got to talk to and whom you engaged as a result of your connection with Sonny?
Yeah, like a really important one would be Katarina Fake, who is the founder of Flickr and founder of Hunch. Through Katarina, we were introduced to Andy Bayo, and Andy was an early advisor of ours and our CTO for a little while. Andy founded a site called upcoming.org in the early 2000s that was sold to Yahoo. He runs a blog called waxy.org, which is one of the best blogs on the web. He's basically the internet's resident nice guy. And so Andy brought us a lot of credibility when we launched and when people first covered us. I think TechCrunch wrote about us the day we launched. I think they said Andy Bayo's new startup. You know, he wasn't a founder. He was involved. But, you know, we would take it. You know, it's great to be associated with him. Mm-hmm. And he also helped us find technical talent. So, mm-hmm. you know, a hard task when you're not technical yourself is you meet someone and you have no idea of how to tell how good they are. So that was a big help. And basically, just for the moment we met Sonny, there was momentum.
Right. And you also have gotten support from people like Jack Dorsey, one of the Twitter founders. Is it financial support, among other things?
Yeah. He's an angel investor. We have a few really interesting angel investors, him, Joshua Schechter, who founded Delicious, and Katarina, who I mentioned, and Fred Wilson and Union Square Ventures are our primary backers.
We talk about, you know, crowdsourcing. Did you in any way feel like, oh, as I'm starting a company related to crowdsourcing, that's what I'm doing myself, is getting a crowd of people kind of funding my business?
Well, it's funny. When we would go around with the idea and we were just, you know, a couple people with a piece of paper, people inevitably would suggest, why don't you kickstart Kickstarter, you know, get people to put the money in and create the company that way. And SEC regulations prevent any exchange of equity on a case like that. But we did take that tact in the sense that we thought, let's get as many people as possible who we think will believe in the idea, who can be advocates for us, and let's get them to put in, you know, just a small amount of money. So that's definitely been a conscious approach that we've taken because, you know, one of the big ideas of Kickstarter is that a community could be a great sense of support and encouragement, and they can spread your word far, you know, spread word about your project far and wide, and we definitely thought very hard about that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. We'll hear more from Yancey coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a leading crowdfunding site. The company enables the public to fund creative projects related to film, food, design, and music. So if you're a musician who wants to create an independent album, you can go to Kickstarter, describe your project, how much money you need, and hope that visitors to the site will contribute. Yancey co-founded the company in 2009 with Perry Chen and Charles Adler. There's a book by James Surowiecki called The Wisdom of Crowds, where the more independent people you have in a population, the more accurate an answer or an outcome will be. To what extent was that kind of ringing in your ear when you were getting this off the ground, if at all?
We read it. I mean, that came out at the time that we were working on this, and it was certainly intriguing. You know, it's nice to get that pop psychology reinforcement for what it is you're thinking about.
But that's all that it was?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were driven by a few different things. I mean, a sort of a core motivation was this acknowledgement of the fact that for an idea to have any value in culture, it had to generate money. That ideas that did not, in the end, generate revenue for someone else were considered valueless. You could not get a loan for those ideas. You could not get a venture capitalist to invest. You could not get a film studio to be, you know, to finance that. A record label would be scared of it. Everyone's just looking for a return on investment because they're businesses. But yet, you know, 99% of ideas are just ideas. It's a thing in your head that you want to have exist in the real world. If it makes you money, great. No one's going to, you know, cry about that. But in the end, you just want the thing to happen. You want that personal satisfaction. So we thought, you know, we could construct a place that functions differently, where ideas are judged based on the passion of the person behind it, the quality of their craft, the connection with their audience, and what the audience itself thinks. You know, the means of doing that was almost secondary to that idea. So, you know, we get called a crowdfunding site accurately. You know, that's sort of the term the web has come up with to describe these kinds of things. But that's not a word that's anywhere on our website. It's not a word that's ever spoken about in our office. It's not a word that we ever talked about leading up to this. I mean, I could care less about crowdfunding. It's a mechanism. You know, really, it's this bigger idea that matters. This crowdfunding thing is just a means to get there.
Right. You are enabling creators to create regardless of what a market might say.
Absolutely.
How does Kickstarter work?
So Kickstarter funding is all or nothing. So I create a project. I say how much money I need to complete it, and I give myself an amount of time to reach it. We suggest 30 days. That's the typical thing that people do. So we need $5,000 in 30 days. Now, if that person is able to raise that $5,000 or more by the time of that deadline, at that point, everyone is charged, and that person gets their money, and they go and they do their thing. If they come up short of their goal, then no one is charged at all, and everyone just walks away like nothing happened. Now, people choose to back projects because they get something in exchange. So it's not a tip jar. It's not a donation platform. So if I give you $10, I get $10 of something back, a copy of the CD, a copy of the book. For higher amounts, you offer, you know, more experimental things or experiential things. So I'll name a character after you, or I'll come do a reading at your house, or we'll play a private show, or you get a walk-on role in the film. People are able to offer whatever it is that they want to do. And so 44% of projects thus far have reached their goal successfully.
Can you talk to me about some of those people who have pitched their project online? What are some of your favorite ones?
There's a project that we had early on by a woman named Emily Richmond, and she's an artist from L.A., and as part of this project, she is sailing around the world alone. It will take her 2 years to circumnavigate the globe alone, and which is a crazy thing to do. And so one of her rewards, the things that she offered, was for $15, at some point on her trip, she would take a Polaroid picture. And next time she got into port, she would mail it to you from wherever she was. And about 4 months ago, 3 months ago, I got an envelope in the mail with strange stamps on it. And I opened it up, and there was a map. And written on one side of the map was my name. And I unfolded it, and tucked inside was a Polaroid picture. And the background was the ocean, you know, faded Polaroid. And the foreground, a jungle and a beach. And on the map, she had circled the island where she was sitting in the South Pacific. And on the other side, she'd written a letter describing what she saw as she took the photo. Mm-hmm. And I got this for $15. And this is something that is romantic and that has enormous, you know, emotional meaning to me. And I'm just a stranger on the internet, you know. And so that sort of thing can happen.
You contributed $15. How much was she looking to raise altogether?
She's trying to raise $7,000, and she raised about $7,500, something like that. Another one I really like, I like these sort of quixotic projects. They're where my heart kind of lies. There's another one called The Mysterious Letters, and it's by a guy and a girl who are both British. Their names are Michael Olenka, and they had the very simple idea that they wanted to write everyone in the world a handwritten letter. And they were going to start with some small, specific towns. So they did a project on Kickstarter to do one in a neighborhood of Pittsburgh called Polish Hill. And so on one day, 623 residents of Polish Hill received letters from Michael Olenka. Again, all, you know, very idiosyncratic. And predictably, people freaked out and got very scared. And it got reported to the FBI and became a big story there. And people started hanging up signs around Polish Hill that said, "Don't worry, it was an art project." There was an amazing story in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette of the reporter interviewing the shop owner, this older woman. And she was said that she thought it was a nuisance that this letter got, and that she thought it was scary and it could be terrorism and these whole ideas. And in the story it said, after the reporter writing, "After I explained to her that it was an art project, the woman removed the letter from the wastebasket and carefully smoothed it out." And I just thought that was wonderful.
When the public contributes money to support a project, it's not investing. And that's because it's illegal in the United States, although internationally regulation is different. Was that a roadblock initially, or was it your intent initially just to have people contribute?
The intent from the beginning was to not have any equity or any points or anything change hands. And that was the intent even before we knew it would be against the law, even if we thought the other way. I mean, the thinking there was that if we're asking people to look at these things and try to guess whether or not it will be a hit, you're just recreating the same mouse cage that we already have, where people are just trying to get, you know, looking to make a buck off of something. And if someone's being motivated by royalty check in 3 years for $13. What is that? Is that a better world? And so we always like this idea of it being about experiences and products that you get in exchange. Mm-hmm. So there's never any sort of equity or you know, financial return that swaps hands on Kickstarter. It's strictly forbidden.
What other forms of crowd support has there been in history? Is there a precedent for this?
There is. I mean, what's funny is that this is not novel at all, in a way. You know, the original forms that art was primarily produced was through patronage, and it was patronage by the church, by royalty, by the Medici, by rich people, basically, in general. And Beethoven would perform a lot of his symphonies this way, where he would say, "I will only perform this when the hall has sold out, and that's the only way this work will be debuted." You get your name in the program. I mean, it's the exact same thing as now. Whitman used to publish some of his books in that same way. In the front of the books, he'd list all the people who helped pay for this first run of printing. And so there are hundreds of examples of art being made in this way. And then right around the middle of the 20th century, we started to switch this idea of corporations subsidizing, commoditizing art, and that being the primary way that art was funded.
While this crowd support has been in existence for centuries, to what extent do you think the appetite is ripe for it now? I mean, you've been enabled by Twitter and Facebook existing, but how much have they facilitated what you're trying to do?
The lifeblood of our site is social media. At this point, Kickstarter is mentioned on Twitter about every 8 seconds, I believe it is. So people are just talking about it all the time, talking about their projects, and it's how things are getting discovered. When we were working on this in 2005, there wasn't a Twitter. I guess Facebook probably existed, but I'm not a Harvard grad, so I was not allowed to be a part of it. I mean, it was a MySpace world at that point, and you know, I'm not really sure. I think we had a MySpace widget idea for how people would spread the word, but it was unclear. And so this whole world has grown around this that's allowed this to exist in a much easier way.
Accidentally.
Yeah, accidentally.
What do you think the appetite is for something like this in other countries?
We have no way of knowing. I think that until you see it and interact with it, a lot of what we do sounds very utopian and maybe a little naive. And I think we are a little naive, but we're all right with that. And, you know, we think about this the way that Twitter or Facebook have grown, where, you know, when your first friend started a Twitter account, you probably made fun of them. You know, you thought that's ridiculous. Like, why would you ever do such a thing? And then over time, you realize the purpose that it serves, and it becomes a part of your life as well. And this is this gradual socialization of these new kinds of services, these new means of expression. And we're on that same kind of timeline, and we have that same level of patience for this. I feel sure that with time that this can be a thing that everyone will feel comfortable with.
So artists have this reputation of feeling uncomfortable talking about the business side of their work, yet your site is all about artists connecting with potential supporters or sources of money. Can you talk to me a little bit about that dichotomy?
I mean, you're saying out loud how much money you need to do something. And the way the site is structured, it's not just about money. It's more about the thing that you're doing. But yet, we're all very uncomfortable talking about money in public. We'd rather talk about anything else than money. And for artists in particular, you know, you're just running for money. You don't want to think about it. That's part of the point. And so there is that level of discomfort, and there's that hurdle that we have to get over. And I'm incredibly sympathetic to it. I mean, I feel very similarly. And I also think that people aren't sure about putting themselves out there in the world. You know, J.D. Salinger would be a terrible Kickstarter creator. You know, it's not for everybody. But I think that with time, people can see that this is about more than just the cash. It's about opportunity. It's about building an audience, all those other things.
Along those lines, you know, I asked you prior to the interview, well, how much money have you raised? And you don't want people to know that, which is compatible with this whole artist mentality of wanting to keep that separate. But that doesn't necessarily work anymore. I mean, you see artists, they have to be great marketers, and it's in their best interest.
It's true. You know, for us, in talking about our own financial backing and our own, you know, things like that, we don't view it as being terrifically interesting. So we just didn't feel like that added anything to our story, that it didn't feel like us. It was someone else's story of us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a company that enables the public to fund creative projects. Do you know anybody else with the name Yancey, incidentally?
I've heard tell. There was an NFL player named Yancey. There's an actress named Yancey, but I've never met anyone face-to-face. It's a Southern last name, traditionally. I was named after a family friend. I hated my name for a lot of my life, and only when, it was in high school, I decided to embrace it. But yeah, it's an unusual one.
So going back to the early days of the company, what was more challenging for you than you thought? I mean, you've had kind of a charmed existence, having the support of the media and this strong network of people helping you out.
Well, those people were not there always. You know, when we launched, it was just us. We were a team of five. We had no one of any weight behind us. We had no big investment, and when we go around to venture capital firms and talk to people about our idea, people did not like it. People did not respond to it. I think that we had that four-year gap where the site couldn't launch, and that was not a happy period. And we would have launched that site in 2006 if we could have, but we couldn't. And you know, you wake up in the morning and you think, is today the day that the three people in Palo Alto with this exact same idea, they launched theirs because they worked a little bit harder, you know, and you have these kinds of anxieties, and no one was getting paid, and it was, you know, it was bootstrapping all the way. You know, I think that there was a lot of emotional toll of especially me having a full-time job and my partners being both fully committed. That caused a lot of stress and a lot of tension, as you can probably understand. Now the problems are interesting. Now the problems are growth.
You founded the company with Perry Chen and Charles Adler, and they were working on the company full-time, and you weren't. So why did they keep you on board as a co-founder if you weren't carrying your weight?
That's a good question. I don't know. We're friends, so that helps. It was not a great period. I don't know the answer to that.
You have a part of your site devoted to product design, and that has been somewhat controversial. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So we started Kickstarter as a platform for creative projects. We meant that pretty broadly. So that's film, music, tech, comics, you know, dance, all kinds of things like that. And then in September 2010, we had a project from two guys in New York named Dan and Tom, and it was a project called The Glyph. And it's a tripod mount for an iPhone 4, and it's a little simple piece of rubber. And they put together a video where they explained how they designed this thing, and they had a very clever sort of commercial for it. And it was a very, very well-done project. And they put it in the design category, and it was a design project, and they were trying to raise $10,000, and they raised about $140,000 very quickly. And the project is basically functioning as a pre-order mechanism. People were buying the glyph from them. And that was the first time we'd had a project like that. And it opened the floodgates to a lot of product design kind of things. And quite a few of those were terrible, and we turned most of those down. But at one point, we had another big one come through by a man named Scott Wilson, who's a designer who lives in Chicago, who designed the Xbox Kinect, among a lot of other big things. And he had a project called the TikTok. And what he did is he designed a watch band that would turn an iPod Nano into a wristwatch. And he was looking to raise $15,000 to do it. And after a month, the project ended with him raising $945,000. And so for his project, that was functioning as a pre-order mechanism, and some 14,000 people bought this thing. But more than that, they also got a story that they were part of. They were part of the creation of this phenomenon. I mean, it was international news, this project. And all those people got bragging rights and got to be a part of it. But it's also more commercial than the kinds of things that we have traditionally supported on Kickstarter. I mean, our biggest category is documentary film. Documentaries have raised, you know, $15 million on Kickstarter. And something like this, you know, the creation of like a gadget seems a little bit divorced from that. You know, because of the success of the TikTok and other projects like it, we've had a real influx of proposals of people looking to do these kinds of things. And we lit in almost everything at this point after a lot of internal debate. We sort of opened wider to this, but we're still not entirely sure how we feel about it. You know, we like this idea of Kickstarter being a place where you put an idea into the world and the crowd decides, right, whether or not it should happen or it shouldn't. But yet we're not a fully open platform. We don't allow everything. So this has really pushed some of our philosophy a little bit. And to be honest, we're not entirely sure where we stand.
To some extent, these people, even if they have the commercial incentive, are still creators and they're still being creative. So
yeah, just because they happen to work in a different medium than one I feel more comfortable in, you know, that's just as much about my bias as it is anything. And we're very aware of that. Mm-hmm. And we're also aware that, you know, when we started Kickstarter, it was ours. It was this idea we had to protect. But with each day, it's a little bit less ours. And it's more just a thing that exists on its own in the world that a lot of people contribute to. So, you know, you even have to question how much a voice do we have the right to have about mm-hmm. this thing.
What do you do outside of work that gives you pleasure right now?
Right now it's primarily riding my bike. But, you know, outside of that, I read. I read, you know, 3 or 4 books a week probably.
What 2 books have you read this week?
Well, let's see. Right now I'm reading the Tom Shales Oral History of ESPN, which I find fascinating and I actually find to be a really good startup book because it's about the origins of this, what is now a huge, huge company just based on being founded by 2 men and basically how they lost control of the company and how it's become this other big thing. And then I'm reading The Bridge, the David Remnick biography of Obama. I recently read The Medium is the Massage by Malcolm McLaren, which is a classic 60s sort of post-Marxist theory book about sort of the philosophy of media that's amazing. I read that 3 times in a day. It's a little 100-page book. And another one that was I really love, I've read multiple times, is You Are Not a Gadget by Jaron Lanier, which is a really good book about sort of some philosophies of technology. And he takes a very sort of pessimistic view in a lot of ways about, you know, what technology has done for us. And I enjoy reading those kinds of opinions.
He advises Microsoft.
I believe he does. He also invented virtual reality, and he does. He's a very smart man with some crazy ideas.
Yes, and he has great dreadlocks.
He does.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. Coming up, we'll hear from Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guests are Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. They were pioneers behind making chocolate from the actual bean to the bar, and they're part of a group of food artisans who produce their own cheese and chocolate and knives and meats, and they're part of a local barter community in Williamsburg. Welcome, Michael. Welcome, Rick.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Before we get started, I just want our listeners to know what I'm looking at, which is 2 brothers who have massive beards. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how long it's taken you to get your beards to the length that they are.
Well, originally, we sort of made a wager with ourselves when we first decided to do this. We made a wager that after we would make and sell successfully 1,000 chocolate bars, we were not going to shave. And by the time that happened, we were sort of accustomed to them and they were sort of part of who we are. And we thought it sort of symbolized what we do. So we keep them, much to our wives, my wife and his girlfriend's dismay. Yeah.
We held true to that. And it took about maybe 8 months before we sold our first 1,000 bars.
How would you describe what Mast Brothers Chocolate is?
Well, simply we describe it as American craft chocolate, a sort of term that goes beyond just being a slogan. Just taking pride in one's work as a craftsman or a craftswoman, you know, that it's not just for my brother and I, but it's for the people that work with us in our factory. It's also just people that work in our community, in our food artisan community, and beyond food artisan community. It's being a part of a community of furniture makers. You know, there's a resurgence in furniture makers. There's a great knife maker in Brooklyn. There's all sorts of great cheese makers, beer makers, wine makers. So whether it's, you know, from woodworking to food, it's a sort of self-dependence and a pride in what you make with your hands.
Rick, before you were making chocolate with Michael, your brother, what were you doing?
I was working in kitchens and restaurants all around New York. Worked briefly at Gramercy Tavern. Worked briefly at Soho House. Worked briefly under Jacques Torres.
Gramercy Tavern, which is owned by Danny Meyer, the restaurateur, and Jacques Torres. He's a chocolate maker.
So what we do is make the chocolate that maybe someday he would use to make his confections with. We are the tree grower or the logger to somebody else, to a carpenter's, you know, creation of something they would make with wood, you know.
And before you were working in the culinary life, what were you doing?
Before that, I was a classical musician. I studied piano and composition and was obsessed with opera. And I always dreamt of actually using a similar approach and mentality and vision to what we're applying to chocolate with opera. I always thought that opera was the ultimate liberal arts education. That's what I'd always say. You can learn everything about life by working in an opera.
Why do you say that's the case for opera, and how is that then carried on to your making of chocolate?
Well, with opera, you're learning about languages, you're learning about history, you're learning about physical building of sets, you're learning about math with the composition of scores, you're learning so much, and you're working with the team, all of that. Well, I think that, which you just learn about the necessities of life. Food, shelter, music, art, those are the things, family, friends, those are the things you need in life. So to sort of be a proponent of it that, and really push it out there to the public about how beautiful it can be and how important it is and how pure it can be, it doesn't have to be so complicated. That's important to me. I'm not sure if I made sense there, but I tried to in a roundabout kind of way.
I think
it
does.
Yeah.
How did you decide to go from opera to chocolate?
Well, it was opera to food, music to food. So I, my brother was living in New York. I was living in California at the time. And I decided to move out to New York and crashed on my brother's couch and started getting into food. Started first, just briefly worked at a local restaurant in Williamsburg, and then decided after about a week or two of that that I need to study and really work at this like I worked at classical music. So then I went to culinary school.
Michael, what were you doing before starting this company?
Well, I originally came out here after I graduated from college in 2001, and my goal was to work in independent films and maybe one day be a film producer. And so my path was working in production and in financing and accounting for different films or TV shows.
You're both from Iowa. What did your parents do in Iowa?
Our mother works for the dean of the graduate college at the University of Iowa, and our father passed away a few years ago.
Yeah, our father was a carpenter, and but he fought in Vietnam and went through the shit, as they say. So he had lots of problems, and our mom was always sort of a champ and grew us, raised us on her own. We have an older sister as well.
What influence did you have from them, if any, in the path you chose? I mean, yes, your father was a carpenter, so there's that obvious link with working with your hands.
Mm-hmm. And that's about it. I think that what our mother taught us was self-reliance and work ethic. I think that it goes beyond stereotype that Iowa boys work harder than everybody else. Mike and I have a sort of unwavering work ethic that we wake up, no matter how much we fought or how whatever happened in our personal lives, we'll always wake up and get the job done and work, you know, pretty devastatingly exhausting hours.
What was that moment when you both said, Rick, you're living on Michael's couch, and you said, okay, we're going to start this chocolate company. How come it wasn't cheese or milk or butter?
Well, I think that it could easily have been cheese or butter. I'm interested in all of them, and we both are interested in all of them. It was chocolate specifically because chocolate is probably far and away so associated with American culture because of such a favorite food of Americans. And so when we were searching out, we're like, oh, how is chocolate made exactly? After learning about how to make cheese and all these other things, chocolate was the next on the list. So how do you make chocolate? Well, let's go ask. So we'd go to shop after shop after shop, and they'd say, how is chocolate? We'd ask them how chocolate was made, and they would say, well, we put the chocolate in this tempering machine, and then we make these, you know, various shapes or bonbons or truffles. And we're like, no, no, how is the chocolate made? Chocolate doesn't grow on trees. It's a recipe of it's what happens after you make something. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized, no one knows and no one is doing it in all of New York City. New York City? So we were just like, wow, this is insane.
Why do you think no one else in New York City was making chocolate from the bean?
Well, I think that from a business perspective, the profit margins aren't exactly through the roof. You could make a lot more money selling truffles and bonbons and confections than you can making it from the bean. It also, there's no such thing as commercial equipment for it. You can't say, I'm going to start a small chocolate company and then go online and get a couple machines. Almost all the machines that we started with were made for something else. For instance, our first granite stone grinder that we used was made to grind rice, and it was sourced from India. And we had to do some alterations to it for it to be used for chocolate. So it truly is a start from scratch, including the equipment.
We talk about how craftsmanlike you are, and it seems like such an ironically novel concept, you know, in the 21st century, when really you're just getting back to the very fabric of human existence. And it's amazing how far we've moved from that.
It's incredible. Yeah. People go on Brooklyn food tours, and people come with their cameras around their necks, and they're like, look, these people are making chocolate from scratch. We're going to go to the butcher and watch him butcher meat. Wow. You know, it's like,
we really just wanted to simplify everything too. And that's why we're so open about what we're doing and how we have an open factory, just so people can really see what's going on. And there's no mystery behind it, or there's no mystery in the ingredients or the process.
Could you just walk me through briefly the process, how you are going from bean to bar?
We source our beans currently from Madagascar, from Brazil, from Venezuela, and from Dominican Republic. We also have a relationship with some farms in Belize. And when I mention these countries, it isn't just a country. We have specific farms from each country. After we get the beans, we actually just have a big butcher block table. We spread the beans out on there, and we sort through them by hand. We literally go through each bean, and any piece of bark, any piece of just empty husk, any stone, we sort out. After that, we roast the beans. It's a very delicate roast. And we roast in an oven that we got from a restaurant called Marlowe & Sons, which is sort of a community hub for food artisans. And we just traded it for chocolate. So it's just really awesome to live in a community where that's possible.
To barter.
Yeah, exactly. After that, we crack all of the beans by hand. We took an old piece of an old grinder or mill that is commonly used for breaking up barley when you're making home brew, when you're making beer. Then we have to separate the husk from the bean. So we collaborated with a friend of ours who has a business in Red Hook. He's actually an engineer, like an aerospace engineer. So in his, you know, in his side project, for while he's building equipment for satellites, he's just a young guy like us, you know, that's up to no good, you know. So he is collaborating with us to build this winnower, and by winnower I mean a contraption that separates the husk from the meat of the bean, and it's beautiful. After that, you have the cocoa nibs. So,
and the nibs are what are inside the husks.
Absolutely, yep. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis, the foundation of all chocolate. So we have these beautiful granite stone grinders, which is basically a mechanized version of the old way that people may have seen in encyclopedias or books of Mayan women are putting have a granite roller over a granite stone, and they're just going over the chocolate and combining it with cane sugar or vanilla bean. Large commercial companies use stainless steel, and we just find that the stainless steel will basically almost burn out the flavor. So we do a slow 3-day grinding process. Then we add the sugar. We have a very specific sugar philosophy. Each bean gets treated with a different sugar just for flavor, to construct like perfect flavor profiles.
When you say each bean, you're saying each bean from a country.
Right, yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, or each varietal. Our mentality is that, for instance, Madagascar has a very sort of citrusy, almost like a sour cherry flavor to it, a little bit of a raisin flavor to it, kind of winey And I love that acidic, pure, clean flavor of it, and I don't want to disrupt it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you necessarily need to use that raw sugar is always going to be the perfect pairing. So in this case, we use something that's a little bit more refined, something that, provides sweetness, but not a lot of distracting flavor.
Walk me through the process of coming up with the name for your company. Were you considering anything else?
I think it was pretty, we knew it right away.
I've taken some business classes and in the food industry business classes and stuff like that. And they would always say, you know, whatever you do, don't involve your name in the company, because if it goes down, you don't want your name to go down with it. There's no accountability or responsibility for anything. So that is what I think is so important about calling our company Master Brothers Chocolate and really taking the responsibility of being the face of it. The Master Brothers has other more personal and intimate implications, and that's that our father and my uncle, they're always known as the Master Brothers, and they used to just raise hell in their small town in Primgar, Iowa. And they're infamously the Master Brothers, you know, much to their now ex-wives' dismay. I think that we also wanted to get back that name.
Talk to me a little bit about the dynamic of working with family. When you were first starting out, for example, did you know how you would get along?
On the subway ride over here, my brother and I were talking about what really is it about working with family that draws you together, and what we came up with that you will never fight for anybody harder than a family member, and you will never fight harder with anybody but a family member.
Well, we had been living together for a few years before we even took on this venture, or even had a notion that we'd be starting a chocolate company together. But we had that time of about 3 or 4 years of having many fights. You know, not just mental fights, physical fights. And you know, we got through those, and we still have those on occasion.
Is there a theme to the nature of your fighting?
We don't fight over what we say to each other more so than the way we talk to each other. And the tone of how we talk to each other. And
it's always the tone. It's just the tone.
And then that just brings up, you know, past arguments or fights that we need to steer clear of.
And of course, it's always his tone that's wrong, not mine.
Definitely always Rick's tone.
Because we know that we've survived so much, like, together, just growing up, and also just we've lived through arguing about way worse things than a chocolate company. Mm-hmm. So if we've survived that, we can survive anything. But that also opens the door to more arguments. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about the psychology of that, if you know somebody that you work closely with, that you know that you're going to live to see another day, no matter how you treat them, you might take advantage of that sometimes.
Right, because you know you'll never lose them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we cross the line more often than we should. And
welcome to therapy on NPR.
Exactly.
And also, we just had some extreme successes. We are now the restaurant Per Se is using our chocolate, and
Per Se is one of the leading restaurants in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And we have such respect for Thomas Keller and his crew that to me, coming from that from a restaurant background, is like a dream come true. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So. And we're so busy now that we used to be able to celebrate each of these new things that happened. So a couple of years ago, we would, celebrate.
After selling 30 bars at an artist's market.
Like we did with, you know. And so now we have these beautiful new things that are happening, and we don't have any time to celebrate them because we have the next thing to do. And that really takes a toll. You know, you never just get to breathe and just, oh, that was nice, you know.
Do you have any grand visions for what you'd like the company to become? Or are you taking it more on a kind of incremental basis?
Definitely an incremental basis. It's that we've been very dedicated to that and are sticklers to that, because already we've had many, many opportunities to grow super fast and build a huge factory offsite somewhere and all this kind of stuff. And we've deliberately turned it down. When we first started, we were very dedicated to slow growth, just like food should be made slowly, with care. A company should be built under the same manner.
It's kind of like your beards.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Slow growth. Yeah. Slightly annoying and hard to deal with it many times. It's, yeah, it is like a beard.
It's my impression that the way you are living is very close to the way that you want to live. Is that an accurate depiction or impression that I get from you just based on the company that you're building and the website and just my interaction with you, that there's less of a distance between the way you're living and the way you want to live?
I think so. I think that's definitely accurate. I think that part of that might be just the way we grew up, being very content with what you have and appreciative of what you have. You know, we never summered anywhere. We never even heard of the word summering. So we've never desired anything like that, you know. So there's an appreciation for hard work, for working hard. And so since we're doing that, then we're pretty content. I was joking with Stephanie, who works with us, about how I was telling her how I just finished organizing my pantry with my wife, and everything is like in these nice mason jars. Everything is divided up by, like, you know, grains, pasta, all this stuff. And so she started thinking, wow, so your life is, you're making chocolate, then you go home with your wife and you like look through your beautiful pantry of old timey mason jars and all of this stuff. And I said, I had to stop her. I'd be like, whoa, wait. It's not, we'll, you know, we get Chinese food with the best of them. You know what I mean? When we're exhausted. So, you know, we have cable TV, you know? So.
Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us.
My guests have been Michael and Rick Mast, founders of Mast Brothers Chocolate, an American craft chocolate company located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.